and gentlemen, it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
We find the defendant guilty.
Quite frankly, I'm still in a state of shock.
Aaron Hawker and his wife Kathy say they noticed the West family cleaning out the garage early Saturday, about 9 a.m. By noon, a swarm of police cars had arrived on scene and caution tape was roped around the property.
We were wondering, what the heck is going on?
Yeah, we were worried about her because we could see that she was not looking in good health. And we were worried about the children that lived there with her. Her three daughters lived there.
Well, hello there.
Hey, what's up?
It's another week.
Another week.
Another week. Another devastating case.
Oh, cool.
So, sorry about that. Yeah. I know last week we were a little emotional.
Yeah.
And when I say we were, it was mainly me sobbing into the mic, so I apologize.
It's okay. It was a pretty... I mean, we've gotten a lot of comments and messages saying that they cried too, so I'm glad we all shared the same emotion. So
yeah, it was definitely a tough one last week, and I hate to say it, but this week's not going to be any more, I guess, better in a way. So I do want to kind of give a little warning for this week. I know Molly's usually the one that does children cases for the most part. This has a lot of, I guess, like, there's certain political views, like on abortion, there's drug addiction, postpartum depression. So if you're a parent or you're expecting, or you just had a baby and you're going through like your postpartum stages, I highly recommend you just skip this week and tune in next.
All right. Well, I'm ready as ever.
So I guess we will just dive right in, right?
Dive right in.
Like normal.
Like normal.
So I'm going to actually start this out in April of 2014, where Darren West, he was actually a man who was just released from prison on drug-related charges. Now, he did get clean while in prison, and he was very upset that he had to leave his family to serve such a very long sentence. He was serving 9 years for this drug-related charge. And when he did get out, because he lost his family, he just kind of wanted to make it up to his wife and three daughters. But, of course, after 9 years, it's kind of hard to reconnect. Now, his two eldest daughters at the time were considered young adults. They were in their very early 20s, and their youngest daughter was around 15 or 16 during this time. While Darren was in prison, his daughters were still living in his home, and at first, they were living with their mother, Megan, but later on, their aunt actually moved in and started taking care of these children by herself. We'll get into the details later on kind of what leads up to that, but for now, Megan is no longer living in the home and she's not really taking care of her three daughters. Now, after Darren was released from prison, he still had hope that they can be a happy family again. And at first, he thought, what a great way to welcome my wife back into our home if it's clean and we just start from fresh. Now, he and his girls decided to tackle the house. They pretty much got it ready. They did some spring cleaning like normal, and eventually they moved on from the house to the garage. Now, they were looking through older stuff so they can see what they needed, what was old, what could be donated, just the normal family things when you're kind of, you know, starting new. And while they were picking out boxes, they did find a box on a shelf in the garage, and it was labeled Christmas. Now, this was exciting for him and the girls because they thought, what a fun way to look back on, you know, happy memories. They get to look back on their Christmases, the old ornaments, the trees. Well, he decided to open the box, go through the items, and he found a shoebox. He thought this was odd. What is a shoebox doing? Maybe there's ornaments in it. Instead, he found a plastic bag. When he opened the shoebox, there is this pungent odor coming from the plastic bag inside, and when he opened it, he shuffled around some fabric and found a baby stuffed inside this box. Now, Darren and his children immediately panic, and they call 911. After he talks to the dispatcher, he calls his ex-wife to tell her the news. Now, he did expect to have some emotion coming from his wife, Megan, and instead, Megan panics, says she had a miscarriage years ago, begs her current boyfriend for a gun so she can take her own life.
Saturday morning, Megan's ex-husband was seen cleaning the garage.
And he was upbeat and everything was good.
That same morning, police got a call.
They came across a suspicious box.
Inside the box,
an infant that was deceased in the box.
They were cleaning out the garage and apparently going to take a lot of it to the junkyard.
Came across a suspicious package. Had kind of a pungent odor.
Yeah, Darren West discovered the infant remains April 12th. So he's the one that makes the call as he's cleaning out that garage, right? He'd gotten out of prison, cleaned out the garage. She had moved out 3 years prior. So he's the one that made the call April 12th.
I'm actually going to pause the story here so you guys can kind of hear more about Megan and her family and the backstory. Now, Megan Huntsman was born on February 27th in 1975. She was born in Pleasant Grove, Utah, which was a very small, quiet little town about 35 miles south of Salt Lake City. Now, this area was very Mormon country for the most part. There was a lot of Mormon beliefs, and everybody kind of knew their neighbors. They were very friendly, and they all went to, you know, the same Mormon church. Now, Megan was the daughter of Blaine Huntsman and Joyce Nelson. Blaine was actually born in 1950 in Manila, Utah. Pretty much their whole family was Utah raised. And Blaine was described as very active in sports and very family oriented. He was very in tune with, you know, his Mormon faith. And he married Joyce in 1981. She shared the same Mormon beliefs, and they decided to have this huge, happy family. There was no background on any mental issues or domestic violence or anything like that. It was just one happy, you know, middle-class family. Now, Megan's classmates would also speak about Megan very highly. They all recalled just having fun sleepovers when they were younger. They would also go hiking. And Megan was described as being very active.
Really nice. I mean, she made cookies for all the kids.
She was always a good babysitter because she babysat my grandchildren.
Now, although she would have fun with her friends, she was actually very shy, quiet, and reserved, according to her mom and younger siblings. She did have a very normal, average childhood, but she was very introverted. Her personality did have an effect on her because she never really wanted to ask for help and she never opened up to anyone. A good example of that was when she was 18. She was still in high school and she got pregnant while dating Darren West. So they met when she was very young. Now, she actually concealed her pregnancy all the way up until the time she was due. When she was due, that's when she left her parents' home, decided to marry Darren in April of 1993, and then had her baby.
Do you think that maybe because of the religious background of her family was what made her so closed off and personal? Like she felt like she couldn't express herself in certain ways because of how her family portrayed themselves?
Now, there wasn't a lot of background on her family, but some of the reports that I did read, it sounded like her faith did have a part in that, but it's not really confirmed or denied. And in reality, there wasn't a lot of information on like the Mormon community in Pleasant Grove. So I think it could have gone either way. In reality, the family was very family-oriented in general, and I'm sure the community was just as family-oriented. So I don't know if the community was kind of like shunning of, you know, younger women getting pregnant, like being sexually active, or if they were kind of like, if you need help, I'm here. Yes, we're upset with you, but we're a community. So it could have gone either way.
Well, from my perspective, she really wasn't very friendly. I did live right next door to her, and we kind of shared, it was one large driveway. I tried to, you know, be friendly with her, but she was very, very quiet and mostly, you know, quite cold. I loved her daughters. They're great girls. And she was just very, very hard to get to know, no matter what I tried to do. And I'm a friendly person, and I went all out. And just, I'm going to say cold kind of person.
Now, Darren West at the time was already graduated from high school. He joined the Marine Reserves and was studying at Utah Valley Community College. His parents were also very middle class. They owned a nice home in a fairly decent neighborhood, and both Megan and Darren lived there after the news broke of their pregnancy. Now, it was a little fuzzy. I don't know if Darren stayed in the Marine Reserves for too long, but soon after, he decided to go into construction to make money for his family. And Megan was cleaning homes and babysitting. So that's how they kind of was able to afford the house they were living at. But they did move into their parents', you know, old home. So in reality, I don't think they really had a mortgage or a lot of bills to really take care of. And the fact that they did move into Darren's parents' house, I feel, does play a huge role in this case. And you'll kind of start understanding why. They did name their first daughter Darian, and she was born in 1993. Now in 1994, they did welcome their second daughter, and she was named JC. Now, just like she did when she was pregnant with Darian, Megan also concealed her second pregnancy with JC all the way up until she could no longer hide it. She was definitely showing and decided to tell Darren that they were welcoming their second child.
He didn't know that she was pregnant with them?
Nope. She concealed her pregnancy all the way up until she could no longer stand it, until she could no longer hide it from people. She would wear baggy clothes. She would not really leave the house. She would just kind of keep to herself. And a lot of people kind of misunderstood her because she was already shy and reserved, and they just thought it was a part of her personality. Now, after JC was born, things seemed pretty normal. However, shortly after, that's when both Darren and Megan decided to kind of dip into some drugs, experimenting with meth and pills. It wasn't long after that that they went from trying it to a full-blown addiction to meth. Megan did admit that it consumed her whole life, but she was also quoted that their marriage, and I quote, decayed into such substance abuse and violence that when she was talking about her life to close friends, she would have black eyes, bruised arms, and this was just all talk about domestic abuse going on in the home. She was always embarrassed to tell anyone about it and would make up excuses when asked.
So was it kind of like the more drugs that they did, the deeper the drug abuse got, the physical abuse got as well?
That's how, honestly, I kind of took it. It kind of seemed like they didn't really care because they cared more about addiction and the drugs than they did about themselves and each other. So, I mean, Megan was already a concealer, so I can't really say whether or not this was true. There was no known behavior of abuse in the home. There is no reports on it, no police arrests, records, nothing. So I can't really say whether or not this actually happened, but there has been witnesses. And in fact, her uncle mentioned that it was pretty severe sometimes, and she wouldn't come around like the family for months on end. But again, the police noted that there was no reports of domestic abuse or violence in the home. So it could have gone either way.
And it's also just really hard, particularly if her natural personality is more reserved and secretive and she does like to keep things to herself, which is a perfectly normal personality trait. But when you add in the domestic violence and then people who are outside forces are like, oh, that's just Megan. Like, Megan's always kept to herself. Megan's always been in her little bubble. It is harder to even detect anything like that because it's not out of her character to be gone for that long.
Exactly. And not to mention, there was meth addiction. So a lot of meth users, they'll have mood swings, they'll have euphoria, anxiety, depression. Some of them will isolate. Some of them will hide. There's, you know, implosive behaviors, violent tempers. There's binge crashing, severe weight loss, open sores, insomnia, sunken cheeks. Like, there's so many things going on with addiction and substance abuse, especially with methamphetamines, that you can't really say whether or not there was actual violence in the home or if it was just the stipulations of drug use.
Yeah. Or a combination of drug use and miscommunication or misinterpreting each other, or just exactly what you said, like, where's the evidence? Where's all of it coming from?
Exactly. Now, there was, of course, you know, like, nervousness and disturbing thoughts that she had had. It just came with the addiction itself. She had a lot of paranoia, psychosis, but she'd never really described her, I guess, emotions and thoughts already, and she already kept to herself. So she just thought that that was just her normal behavior. Now, during this meth addiction, in 1996, Megan became pregnant again. She hid it just like the other two by wearing baggy clothing, staying isolated, and just continued to use meth throughout her whole pregnancy. She even hid this pregnancy from Darren himself, just like the second baby. When she was 9 months along, she then gave birth to this child alone in the house, in the bathroom. Once the birth was completed, she decided she couldn't afford her addiction, two children, and this third. So she chose addiction over the life of her little babe. She put her thumbs on the baby's neck and strangled it within 2 minutes of life. She decided to take a hair tie and wrap it around the little neck. And I quote, just to be sure, it was dead.
A hair tie?
A hair tie.
That just shows you how small that baby was. Like, holy crap. Like, I understand she has like a lot of psychosis and drug use, but that is very savage.
Now, not only did she strangle this baby, she then wrapped it in cloth, put it in a plastic bag, wrapped the plastic bag up, placed it into that shoebox, where it was placed into a bigger box that was labeled Christmas, and it went into the garage.
So do we know exactly how big, like, was it a full baby-sized baby?
So I don't know the exact weight in pounds, ounces, or length, but I do know that she carried this baby full term. It was a full-term baby, so probably anywhere from 6 to 10 pounds. After she gave birth to this baby, and after she put the body in the garage, she cleaned up her mess like nothing happened. She still continued with her addiction, and months after this incident, she got pregnant again. This time, she gave birth in the bathroom while her husband and his brother, as well as his brother's wife, were in the living room watching TV. This is another example of Megan concealing her pregnancy. Darren had no idea she was pregnant for the fourth time. Now, while she was giving birth in this bathroom, she convinced herself again that she was unfit to be a mother because she couldn't take care of the baby while using meth. I do just want to note that Utah has a safe haven law where birth parents can hand a baby to the hospital. It is then taken to the ER just to be checked out, make sure that the baby's good to go. And then family services are called where this baby is placed for immediate adoption. No questions asked. The mother will be anonymous as long as the baby checks out good. And there's no reports to the police. The mother's not going to be investigated. And the mom will not be prosecuted.
That is a luxury.
Yeah.
That is a luxury for the mother and for the child.
And there's a lot of states that don't have the safe haven. There's actually a lot of states that don't even have the abortion laws, which we won't get into those. But the fact that Megan had this amazing, it's a gift. It is a gift for mothers who feel that they can't take care of their children and they don't want an abortion. They have this gift to let this child live its life by and with a family that loves them, that wants them.
Yeah, a family that maybe cannot have a child and they want to save a child and have a child in their life. Like it is, it's like I said, it is a privilege to be able to have that resource, especially the no questions mm-hmm. asked, no exactly. investigations needed.
No consequences. So just like the other baby, she then strangled this one, wrapped it up in plastic, put it in a box within another box, labeled it as something completely random, and placed it into the garage. She then continued to get pregnant again and again, continuing to suffocate and discard her own children, wrapping them in plastic and stuffing them into the box in the garages. Now in 2000, she did find out that she was again pregnant, but with outside factors happening, she actually couldn't conceal this pregnancy for very long. Megan and Darren welcomed another baby girl and they named her Sawyer. She was perfectly healthy, even though she was addicted to meth at the time of giving birth. And it could have been that she stopped using once her and Darren found out that she was pregnant, but there was no confirmed reports on whether or not she was fully using or just using a little bit or completely stopped. There is assumptions that she didn't stop, but probably didn't take part into it as much as usual. Now, between 2000 and 2006, Megan was pregnant 5 more times, which was about once a year. Megan, just like before, would give birth either in the bathroom or she did give birth once on her bed. Now, any mother who has experienced childbirth or anybody who was in a room experiencing that for someone else, you know how messy things can get. Her bed was ruined with brown fluid everywhere. Blood was everywhere. She decided to try to hide the marks and try to discard the mattress.
I mean, this is my feeling, too. I had my last two babies at home. How in the world could you hide something like this? I had a midwife, and supposedly she had no one. And how can you hide something like this, especially from your husband and your other children?
I mean, if she's pregnant all this time and nobody ever mm-hmm. figures it out, and like you said, giving birth, not having any complications, yeah. children.
Herself. Obviously, she's delivering these babies herself. I mean, that's a messy thing to do, and nobody knew about it.
Each one of these 5 pregnancies were concealed. Darren did not know about them. And once again, they were placed into a box in the garage.
Well, Sandy, you know her husband, his estranged husband, too. How could he not notice? How could he? Cops believe he's the one impregnated her all these times and that he's living with her and has no idea. I mean, I find that very hard to believe.
Well, me too. But I do know for sure, been told pretty directly, that her first 2 children, you did not know that she was pregnant. One person said, well, we have to go meet Megan at the hospital. And the other person said, why? She's having a baby. What? Everyone was shocked. And I think it was that way with her first 2 that no one ever knew.
There was later claims that Megan was going through postpartum depression. And I know we've talked about this a little bit in earlier episodes, but I kind of want to dive into a little tiny topic so you can fully grasp everything that Megan was feeling during this time.
Ooh, tiny topic.
I know. We haven't,
me likey.
We haven't done those in a while. Yeah. So I wanted to kind of fit that into an episode. Now, there are 3 different causes of low mood after childbirth. So postpartum depression. There's baby blues, postnatal depression, which is PND, and postnatal psychosis, which we kind of described a little bit in the other episode that we kind of discussed postpartum depression on. But baby blues is very common, and it's actually the most common. And it's kind of normal to have those feelings, especially after childbirth. These symptoms will include a little weeping, irritability, anxiety, just feeling low. Baby blues usually starts around the 3rd day after giving birth, but it can go by like the 10th day of childbirth. usually new mothers who are describing the symptoms of baby blues don't really need medical treatment, and your endorphins will start firing and you'll just start to feel better after a couple more days, and a couple weeks is usually when mothers start to feel normal again. Now, postnatal depression, which is PND, this can occur in about 1 in every 10 mothers. It's usually developed within the first 4 weeks after childbirth, but there has been some cases where it will start several months after childbirth. Now, these symptoms include low mood, it'll last for much longer than the normal baby blues few days, and during this area of postnatal depression, there's a lot of irritability and a lot of anxiety. This can also start forming into depression, and usually if you're describing these symptoms to a doctor, they'll advise treatment. The most uncommon of the three postpartum depressions is the postnatal psychosis. This is actually a severe form of mental illness, and it's going to involve low mood, but there's a number of other factors that go into it. There are certain risks that are higher for women that develop postpartum psychosis. Now, one of these risks is having a family history of mental illness, especially postpartum psychosis itself, having an existing diagnosis of bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. 3 is having a traumatic pregnancy or birth experience. And the last one is having postpartum psychosis after a previous birth. So pretty much still on your depression, getting pregnant again, similar to what Megan was feeling and going through. Now, there is a maternal mental health advocate. Her name is Rachel Water. She actually has a TED Talk explaining the severe effects of the prenatal psychoses. This is technically based on her own experiences, but I want you to hear it for herself, just describing the emotions that she went through during this time in her life. It is very traumatic. And I'm going to play that now.
This is a photograph of my family featuring our 4 healthy, beautiful children. And while the road to this picture was anything but an enviable process, the birth of my daughters, Adeline, in my husband's lap, and Chloe, the baby, found our family, myself and my well-being in particular, teetering on the edge of catastrophe. Today, I want to talk to you about postpartum psychosis. I'm not a psychiatrist or an expert in the field of perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. My experience with this condition is personal. I experienced postpartum psychosis after the births of our 2nd and 4th children. I hope that by sharing my experiences, I can begin to break down the stigma surrounding perinatal mood and anxiety disorders and bring hope and healing to those going through something similar. Our society paints this picture that the only acceptable feeling to have after the birth of a child is overwhelming joy. And while for most, the first few months following the birth of a baby are filled with incredible joy, for many, including myself, this joy is abruptly interrupted by severe depression and anxiety. 1 in 7 women experience a perinatal mood and anxiety disorder in the first year following the birth of their child. Let my story be the catalyst that allows each of you to reflect on your own stories. If I can bring hope to even one mother suffering in silence, then it gives purpose to the trauma that I experienced. Our family moved to Montana when I was 4 months pregnant with our 2nd child. At almost 2 years old, my son was still not sleeping through the night. So as I prepared for the delivery, I was already completely exhausted. A couple weeks after giving birth, I began to fear sleep because sleep brought vivid nightmares. Overwhelmed and fueled by dread, I would lay in my bed at night, But this was more than just insomnia. As in wakefulness, the nightmares still found a way in. I began to lose touch with reality. But I didn't tell my husband about the deeply disturbing thoughts I was having because I was afraid that he would think that I was unsafe to be around the kids if I did. As my mental state declined, panic attacks, hallucinations, and delusions mounted. My son was possessed. There were demons in the bathtub. And all day long, I heard radio music playing in the background, and it was followed by the sound of glass breaking and the play gym crashing over and over. All day long, I fought the voices, and I lived in fear. Remembering the next part of the story is like trying to recall pieces of a dream upon awakening. My husband and I were out for a run, and I suddenly stopped and turned to him and said, I have to go home right now. Say goodbye to the kids. My husband said, why? And I replied, because I'm going to kill them. My husband, who is a physician, recognized that I was experiencing postpartum psychosis. And he immediately took me to the appropriate healthcare professionals, and a treatment plan was initiated. In retrospect, I am so grateful that he had this knowledge and that he knew where to go to get the help that I so desperately needed. It is the unfortunate case that for too many women, their support system has no knowledge regarding postpartum psychosis, and they don't know where to go to get the support that the woman needs before she takes her own life or the life of her child. So what is postpartum psychosis? It is one of six perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, including depression, anxiety, or panic disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, bipolar disorder, and psychosis. Although these disorders can occur at any time in a woman's life, there is a marked increase in prevalence during pregnancy and in the first year postpartum. Postpartum psychosis is a rare maternal mental health illness occurring in 1 to 2 out of 1,000 women who give birth. It is a potentially life-threatening medical emergency, generally requiring rapid intervention, hospitalization, and psychiatric management. Who is at risk for this condition? Postpartum psychosis is strongly and consistently associated with bipolar disorder. Most women who experience it have a history of bipolar disorder or go on to develop bipolar episodes outside of the postpartum period. However, 50% or more of women who experience postpartum psychosis have no psychiatric history. Today, I'd like to talk about three risk factors for postpartum psychosis, the first being familial history. This will be a personal or familial history with bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, or schizoaffective disorder. Trauma is also a major risk factor, especially a childhood trauma of sexual or physical abuse. And finally, insomnia. Sleep deprivation can cause a psychotic break. And there's evidence to suggest that severe sleep deprivation may be a trigger for postpartum psychosis. So what are the symptoms that a woman experiencing this condition may display? There may be delusions, often religious in nature, visual hallucinations, like seeing someone else's face in the place of your baby's face. For me, I saw my face morph into my mom's face, morph into my grandma's face. There may also be auditory hallucinations or hearing voices. This would be the radio music that I experienced. There might also be catatonia in following a psychotic episode. My husband said that after I threatened to kill our kids, that I had a very distant look on my face as if I wasn't even aware of what I was saying. There may also be a disorganized thought process. Leading up to my manic break, I was aware that I was losing touch with reality, and I was trying to make sure that what I was thinking made sense, which it didn't. But I would ask my husband if he saw what I saw or heard what I heard.
So for me personally, the most interesting aspect of what she was talking about was her hearing radio music and like glass breaking. I thought that that was a very interesting aspect, and to constantly have something, I mean, even when you don't have a psychosis, if you constantly are hearing something in your ear, that's so chaotic and so hard to manage and so hard to put into, you know, a place of sanity. So I completely can understand that that would make it so much worse and also scary, because it is kind of scary to have images and
voices. And auditory responses. Absolutely. It's similar to, you know, people not liking when others click their pens or tap their foot or something like that. It's an annoyance that I think we as humans just have in general. And to go through, you know, postpartum depression and psychosis and have those, that constant playing in your head, the auditory response, that could only lead to aggression. Bringing it back to Megan, she never fully admitted to seeing hallucinations and still blames the murders on meth addiction alone. She definitely lost touch with reality, but in my personal opinion, since Megan was a young mother, a concealer, and had a strict Mormon faith, you can only imagine the stress levels related to all of that. Then having her second daughter so close to her first, she probably never got over her psychosis from the beginning.
And she has no outlet. She has no outlet to be saying, hey, I feel this emotion, because she's a natural concealer. So she had absolutely no place to be able to get out any type of emotions that come with pregnancy, whether they're good, bad, whatever it may be. It sounds to me that she felt like she was dealing with everything on herself, by herself. Yeah,
absolutely. Now, mixing this rare maternal mental illness with drugs was probably the worst possible thing that Megan or anyone could do. But since there was no psychiatric history in her family, and like you said, she was a natural concealer, no one would have even guessed that she was going through such a huge traumatic experience. I do want to note that throughout this time period, Darren did in fact figure out that she was pregnant a couple of the times, but Megan would constantly tell him that she would just miscarry. Darren was later quoted, "I knew she was pregnant, but I was so messed up on freaking drugs that I didn't know what was going on." They both had such a huge addiction that, again, they didn't really pay attention to each other or their family. All they wanted was the next fix. I know what most of you are probably thinking. It's the same thing that we're thinking as well. How would a husband just be so high that he wouldn't even notice his wife was pregnant or giving birth to these children? Now, it's not impossible, and women have done this before, and that's what is called the concealer, where women decide to conceal their pregnancy wearing baggy clothes. However, there was a psychology professor at Ohio Wright State University that described concealers to be more teenagers who are just ashamed or afraid of their parents finding out, and I quote, "not grown women with access to birth control and abortion services." So for a woman to do this multiple times, it's exceedingly rare.
It takes a very special cocktail to create this situation. It takes whatever dynamic their relationship had, mixed with drugs, mixed with any outside factor. That is why, and it is rare for a grown woman, especially multiple times, to be able to conceal pregnancy. So like I said, the mixture of everything that's going on in that house, the mixture of their relationships, the mixture of circumstances is ultimately what led this to be a very unbelievable situation, because that's not going to be something that every person that goes through this is going to have all these factors.
Exactly. And personality traits. I mean, Megan was already shy. She was already very isolated and kept to herself. So for her to already have these personality traits that kind of seemed normal when she was a concealer, you know, pregnant with babies and giving birth and hiding, you know, all the blood and everything related to childbirth, that right there is already disastrous. A couple other people did say that they saw Megan throughout this time. Now, while she was pregnant and killing these infants, everyone that saw her thought that she was perfectly happy and healthy. None of them knew about the meth or even the pregnancies. They did notice that sometimes her weight would fluctuate and she was going from baggy clothing to tight clothing back to baggy. But of course, with societal standards, it's very disrespectful to ask a woman if she's pregnant or to just assume, and we teach that in manners. So I feel like a lot of their neighbors and the people who did see Megan during this time didn't want to step on her toes and didn't want to be rude, so they hushed up.
No one knew about these pregnancies?
Apparently not. This is one of the big questions that's out here is, how was she able to conceal pregnancies, births, and then dispose of babies without anybody knowing? Now, we've talked to a neighbor out here who said, well, I kind of noticed that she was gaining weight and I thought she was pregnant, but then it turned into the, you know, public common courtesy. You just don't ask the woman, are you pregnant? And that seems to be what the case was here, was everybody was afraid to go up to her and ask, are you pregnant?
Now, Sandy, let me ask you this question. You said that sometimes, even though most people said they never had any idea she was pregnant, that you kind of noticed something odd. Tell us.
I did. My house is about 100 feet down from the street, and so I'm down a little bit further, not really seeing her front door. And the places that I would see her would maybe be on a deck in their backyard. She lived upstairs. It was a duplex, tight, home. What we call in Utah, a mother-in-law apartment, was the basement. And I would see her many times walking up the driveway, and I would think to myself, boy, she's put on some weight because she's really very tiny, like 105 pounds, 5'4". And I said to myself many times, boy, she looks pregnant. And it was just because the way the tummy looked to me. And I guess just being a mother, she wasn't hiding it very well, in my opinion. And I many times said that to myself, but no baby ever came that I knew. And you kind of dismiss it out of your mind.
Now we're going to fast forward to sometime in 2005. This is when police were notified that Darren was receiving mail-ordered meth ingredients. And during this time, police went to the house, asked Megan to take a look around, and she agreed. Now, you would think that this was also the time that they would find the babies in the boxes. While they did look in the garage, they never found any of the bodies, but they did find enough drugs and paraphernalia to arrest Darren.
Law enforcement came out to the house and supposedly did a search warrant of that house and garage. Did they not find anything then? Did they maybe use drug dogs when they come in? They didn't physically search the garage? Because, Vinny, if you're doing a search warrant and if I'm an investigator, I see boxes, I'm going to be looking inside those boxes.
Darren pleaded guilty in federal court in late 2005 to two counts of possessing chemicals intended to be used in manufacturing methamphetamines. Now, in August of 2006, this is when he was sentenced to 9 years in prison. He did appeal the term three different times and maintained his innocence, saying that he never had any intention to manufacture meth. It was purely for addiction reasons. He was also supplying to Megan, but knowing Megan was in the home with their children, he didn't want to name her. Darren's sister, whose name was Sarah Wright, she wrote to a federal district court in 2006 on behalf of Darren. Now, in this letter, she stated that he was a good father to his three daughters, and she said that he worked at an excavation company for 11 years, is an avid outdoorsman who likes to fish and camp, and I quote, "Darren is such an awesome dad." However, even with good efforts from Sarah, the appeals were all denied. So since Darren was Megan's supplier, when he was arrested, she was kind of forced into a clean lifestyle. She didn't substitute that addiction for another substance per se, but she did fall into alcoholism. So I think that eventually led to the alcoholism in the first place, and especially since she, you know, didn't have Darren, pretty much was still living in her in-laws' home. So I feel like she needed another outlet, which is what led to her alcohol addiction. While Darren was away, his parents did agree to let her and, of course, their children still live in the 3-bedroom home after their son was jailed. Their neighbor, Aaron Hawker, stated that one condition Megan had was that she must stay faithful to her husband while he was inside and not see any other men. However, 5 years later, in 2011, they found out that Megan had not been faithful and actually had another man in the home. Mr. Hawker stated, and I quote, "What I was told by Darren was that she began an affair, and when her in-laws found out, they told her to leave. I do not know how long the affair went on for, but I was told that it was with a coworker." He also mentioned that Megan left that time in 2011, and since she left, no one has really heard or seen her at the house. Her in-laws stated that she was not welcome in this home. Now, although she was forced to leave the house, Megan's family and friends told her that this was the perfect time to get a divorce, but she still refused and claims that she will always love Darren. Her uncle also mentioned that she had no self-esteem, which probably led to her not filing for divorce. It was around the same time in 2011 that her eldest daughter, Darian, just turned 18. Although Megan left, her children stayed in the home, and an aunt on Darren's side, her name was Mary West, moved into this house to help look after the girls. Megan, on the other hand, moved in with her mom because her mother just received a cancer diagnosis, so another family trauma. She did live there for some time until she decided to move in with her boyfriend, which was the man she had this affair with. His name was Jimmy Brady.
Darren West goes to jail. The father and the husband goes to jail. And meanwhile, the mother stays here and raises those three children. According to neighbors, there was some struggle, a battle possibly with substance abuse, some addiction issues. They just saw her struggling. And there have been some allegations made, some speculation that she having other relationships while her husband was in jail, and that allegedly could have led to their separation, to her moving out of this home in 2011. The children stayed here. The grandparents, other members of the family have been stepping in to raise these kids while their father had been in prison. We're told that he worked very hard to get his life back on track. He was looking forward to this fresh start. So, of course, a discovery like that made pretty much the first day he comes back to his home, you can just imagine. I mean, it's the kind of story that no one ever saw coming.
Yeah, and just to remind our viewers, those children that you're talking about, they were raising three daughters who are now, two of them are adults, 20 and 18, and a 13-year-old.
Yes, three daughters that had lived in this home, the daughters of Darren West, the daughters of Megan Huntsman.
All right. Carly Figueroa, thank you so much.
The rest of 2011 to early 2012 seemed like things were going really well for both Megan and Jimmy. It wasn't until late 2012 where Megan's dad was having chronic leg and hip problems, and that pain would not go away, so he decided to take his own life. This was a huge factor in Megan's mental health, and she began drinking even more than before. After her father's death, Megan's mom noticed that she was drinking very heavily and told Megan that she needed to get treatment for alcoholism. To her mom's surprise, Megan agreed and she sought help and went to rehab. After rehab, she moved back in with Jimmy. And again, it seemed like their lives were really simple and stable. Megan had a job at a local grocery store, and she was working in the bakery, but then later lost this job due to unknown reasons. Sometime in 2013, she became pregnant again. and this time with Jimmy's baby. They did discuss the pregnancy. She did not conceal it this time. However, she later then told Jimmy that she miscarried. There was no evidence. It's all circumstantial. We don't know if she truly miscarried or if there is another body. It's very unknown. But Jimmy did say that Megan did seem very upset by this. So I can only imagine that this was probably a true miscarriage. In early 2014, this is when Darren was released from prison. Now, of course, when he was released, he couldn't just go back to the home. He was actually sent to a halfway house to finish off his sentencing. But after being released from the halfway house, this is when he moved back in to his parents' home, which was the original house where he had his family with Megan. He wanted to be there to take care of his daughters, and their oldest daughter was pretty much already grown with their second daughter following. He thought that after his time serving that he wanted to just make amends with Megan and start over. He wanted his family back. This is when, in April of 2014, he decided to clean out the garage and try to get the home up to standards. When he found the box in the garage and the baby's remains were discovered, he immediately called the police. In the beginning of this story, after Darren called 911, he immediately called Megan. This is when both Darren and Jimmy heard the panicked call. She mentioned that while she was on drugs years ago, she miscarried and hid the remains because she was afraid of the addiction. It took her life over. Now, Darren did tell her that the police were already on the way, and this is when Megan hung up and begged Jimmy for a gun. She wanted to take her own life, but Jimmy wouldn't let her. After the police went to the home and saw the body for themselves, they went to the trailer home where Megan and Jimmy were living to arrest her, and she did give a full confession. Now, she did say that there was not just one body. She confessed to have strangled 6 out of 7 remains that were in the garage.
A neighbor across the street who was too disturbed to go on camera watched through his surveillance video as police carried the lifeless infants out of the dark home.
I don't know how something like this can even happen, but it did.
Police say the Utah woman accused of killing 6 babies and hiding them along with a stillborn couldn't tell detectives exactly how many infants she had in her home. KSTU reports Megan Huntsman told detectives there were 8 or 9 babies in her home, but police said they found 7. Police said 6 of those infants died after Huntsman allegedly strangled them. KTVX notes police also released information from the search warrants that noted the bodies were hidden in Huntsman's garage. One of them was reportedly in a box sealed with electrical tape. Police say Huntsman's ex-husband, Darren West, found one of the babies when he went to get some of his belongings out of the garage. After police arrived, the Salt Lake Tribune reports they found bodies in other boxes, one of them hidden in a cubby and another inside a cabinet. KSL-TV notes Huntsman also has 3 daughters. One of them was born during the time period she allegedly killed the newborns.
She didn't say anything. No outward expression of emotions.
And the crime scene photos have now been released, and we get a look inside that garage. Let me bring in HLN law enforcement analyst Mike Brooks. Mike, as we take a look at these photos, and let's begin here. This is the area we're talking about, the garage. But what I notice here, Mike, is all this debris in this photo down here that you can see that's been removed and was inside that garage.
Right, and all everything here on the trailer, and you know, where are these boxes? Were they all stacked up on top of each other? You know, was it almost like what they call Collier's Mansion conditions, where it was just everything just stuffed in there, like we saw in a case in Ohio where they were looking for the baby, couldn't find her.
Absolutely, and in this photo, we get a little better look inside the garage here, Mike, and a couple things strike me. I see the door over here. I also see this railing over here as well.
Well, apparently, there is another residence or a basement that people were living there.
And that so the entrance to a basement or a basement apartment is in the garage where these 7 babies were.
Right. And that goes to, again, to the question of why didn't anyone smell anything if these boxes had been there the whole time they lived in this house?
Finn. Justice Scott Morgan also joining us on the phone, forensics expert, professor at Jacksonville State University. Let me ask you about that. We're looking at the picture right now of this garage. There's a basement entrance there. How surprised are you that no one could smell the decomposition of 7 little babies in that garage?
Hey, good morning, Ben. Good morning, Mike. Yeah, to me,
it's beyond the pale. I don't see how someone could have walked by this or lived in this environment and have not smelled it. What this gives me an indication of is that someone was indwelling the residence and they were either just completely oblivious to it, or they were denying this to the point where they had convinced themselves that these babies were not down there. This makes this all the more poignant and very, very sad. Again, if you've got other people living adjacent to the area, I would think that this would raise some questions as well. Many times people will just assume, in my experience as a death investigator, they will assume that this is some type of animal that they're smelling that has gotten into spaces in the wall.
I could understand that. Let's take a look at more of these pictures. And here you see the investigators inside the garage. And Mike, again, inside the garage, this isn't a garage where things weren't happening. I mean, you've got fishing poles and fishing nets up here that have to be retrieved. Again, we see the railing in the entrance to the basement. Things like a Christmas tree. At least once a year you're going in the garage to get the Christmas tree.
I don't know what's in this woman's mind, but according to police, she's been relatively truthful with them. When they took her in for questioning, she admitted that she had killed six of these babies, as you say, by suffocation or strangulation. She told police in that same interview that her husband was the father of these children. So again, we won't know for sure until the DNA tests come back.
After the findings, there was a state judge. His name was Stephen Hansen. He set the bail at $1 million for each of the children found.
That's $7 million?
$7 million. After news of her arrest broke, investigators and her neighbors were just puzzled over the discovery and were kind of confused on how she could have concealed pretty much half dozen pregnancies in over the 10-year time period. One of her neighbors asked, "How can you have a baby and not have evidence of other people knowing? You can't plan when a baby is going to come. Just the thought of somebody putting a baby into a box is heartbreaking."
It is odd to me that, because you're right, you can't really tell. You can just go into labor really at any time. So again, the perfect cocktail of her going into labor at just the right times to be able to hide that is crazy. That is crazy.
Exactly.
Oh, I was devastated. To me, it's such a sadness that these little babies never had a chance to come into the world and stay very long. And it just broke my heart and, you know, made me just, you know, sick to my stomach, especially living right next door to her. And then the three daughters, you hate to say it, but she allowed to let live. The older two young adults and the one that's almost 14. Why was she picked when I think about it? And now I just, you know, I could picture every time I look at the garage, seeing those babies in there hidden. And I don't know, it's just devastating that those little ones didn't have a chance.
Chief Smith, thank you for being with us. You know, how does that happen? I mean, maybe once you could fake the world out about your pregnancy, but seven times, Chief?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have the same question, and I agree. You know, one thing to fake the world out, but to fake your own family and husband out is another. And that is an area that we continue to probe into to try to get those answers.
You know, Chief Smith, Kelly in Kentucky wants to know, was it the husband that originally found the first dead body? Is that correct?
That is correct.
Wow. And he probably didn't think that this is connected to his wife. So he calls about the one dead body in the cardboard box. With me is Chief Michael Smith out of Pleasant Grove joining us tonight. But where were the other bodies hidden, Chief Smith?
They were in the same area. They stopped once they found the infant. They stopped what they were doing and called the police, and we responded, and through our investigation found the other infants in the same area the first one was located.
And Chief Smith, are you telling me that the husband says he never knew his wife was pregnant seven times?
Yes, that's that's the information that we have.
Okay, that is a little hard to take in, Chief Smith. Chief, another question. There are seven tiny bodies, but only six homicide charges. What about the seventh infant?
There's information that we have that one of them was possibly stillborn. The infants are at the medical examiner's as we speak, and as those as that investigation unfolds, hopefully we'll be able to determine if how that baby died, and if we need to amend charges at that point, we will.
You know, Chief Smith, I'm just bowled over on. I just remember how helpless and tiny my twins were when they were born. But I heard a report earlier that these babies were full term. Is that correct, Chief?
Yes. We believe they were full term from what we have discovered. They appear to be full term infants.
Oh.
It's hard to wrap your mind around what happened there.
Chief, were they wrapped in blankets? Were they just in the box? How did you find them positioned?
They were wrapped in containers, and they each were in their own container.
You know, I'm just trying to get my head around it, Chief Smith, how you do it not once, but possibly seven times. I mean, we don't know if the seventh one was stillborn or if it was murdered. How do you put your hands as a mother around the neck of an infant and strangle the tiny baby to death? I mean, when I find a bug, I try to put it outside. You know, I wrestle with a bug for an hour to get the thing out the window. Where do you get the mental capacity to murder a child over and over? I mean, this is seven dead bodies. I mean, I can't just even say that. Seven dead infants. I mean, Chief Smith, have you ever seen anything like it in your life?
I haven't, and I agree with you. I don't understand how it could happen. I think that if the day ever comes that you could comprehend and understand, then you've got a problem, because it is just, it's horrific what happened.
And then to just stick, I'm sure in the garage right now, let's see it in full, please, Justin. Then to just stick the cardboard box out there with the old Christmas tree? I mean, really?
Now, the preliminary autopsy report of the seven babies also included DNA samples that were sent to the FBI to confirm whether both Megan and Darren were the biological parents of these children, or if she was having an affair throughout their whole marriage. Darren denied knowing anything about these pregnancies and also denied being the father, since she had been previously unfaithful to him before.
The father is saying, and his whole family's piling on, that she is a, quote, known cheater, that these are not his babies. What do you know, Jim Kirkwood?
Well, that's what he says, but the DNA tests are going to tell us for sure, Nancy, as you know, and that should be coming very shortly. This is the most unbelievable, horrific story. This sleepy little Pleasant Grove bedroom town, mostly religious folks, they're in shock. I know some of them, and they can't believe this, Nancy.
You know, to Aaron Hawker, next door neighbor where the seven tiny bodies were discovered, you spoke with the husband. Did he believe these babies were his, Aaron?
Well, when I spoke to him Sunday, I guess all of us were assuming that this had happened within the last 8 years, but then the police made some kind of a press release and said this happened between 94, 96, and 06. And when I talked to Darren, he said, these babies can't be mine. He said, they got to be from the last 8 years, he thought.
So he is doing the math and saying the babies are not his. To Dr. Michelle Dupree, medical examiner, forensic pathologist, how can you look at a body, the remains, and date them? How can you date the body?
Nancy, it's going to depend, of course, on the condition of the body. If at this point in time they're probably skeletonized or perhaps even mummified, we can look at the evidence around the body, other things like that, but we can just put it into a range. It won't be an exact date.
Well, I'm not so sure of that, Jane, and I'm not so sure that the husband is involved, because why would he go into a garage, discover a baby, and then call the police? If he's involved, he's calling the police on himself. He's a convicted felon. He knows how the criminal justice system works. And also, I want to address the point about the woman being pregnant. I heard one of the neighbors say that she did have fluctuations in her weight, and her weight went up and down. It's very possible for a woman to be pregnant and for people around her not to know, for the woman to conceal a pregnancy. Women do it all the time.
Give me a break. How on earth can somebody get somebody pregnant once a year over a decade and not know that the person's getting pregnant, getting bigger, and giving birth? I mean, come on, we don't have to get graphic here to realize a husband's going to realize that.
Women are pregnant all the time, and people don't know. People on their jobs, people in their community don't know that they're pregnant.
Hey, Jane,
I
have a possible answer. Yes. I have an answer to your question. It might work. I don't think that the husband, everybody's calling him the husband. I don't think he's the father of many of these kids. And I will tell you, there is a controversial law in Utah that permits a woman who's pregnant to somebody who's not her husband. Let's say they're a couple, they're not married, or pregnant with somebody else, another man she's not married to. She has no obligation under the law in Utah to tell that man that she's pregnant with her child. So this could be, it could be coming from somebody else, number one. Number two,
here's a possible motive. The pregnancy stopped.
Can I finish, please?
Let Wendy answer, and then you'll go to the possible motive. Yeah. Wendy.
Go ahead.
I mean, can we have a tiny dose of common sense instead of latching on to absurdities? All the pregnancies reportedly stopped when he went to prison. I mean, come on. Plus, this is his wife. Is he having sex with her? I think so. Would that
I doubt it. She had a motive. She had a financial motive. She had a financial motive to have these kids. Here are two possible theories. One is I would check with the federal government and the state government to find out whether she's committed any kind of welfare fraud, whether she's having children.
That's a good point.
She's now claiming them.
You
got
to keep the
money,
kids alive
stamps,
in order to get the and welfare
number two,
check.
The money. You can't
oh, you
get
don't? The government doesn't even
kids.
Know. The government won't even know whether they're dead or not. She's we hit should, them in the garage.
Come
it's crazy.
Oh, that is ridiculous.
Listen,
we should point out
money is what drives people.
Hold on one second.
Please.
He is involved in some way. He is involved in some way. I'm not saying he's involved in any murders. I'm saying when you look at the pathology of the story, this isn't just about a crazy woman on her own. I'm talking about a very crazy situation, and there's some interplay involving the family, specifically the husband. Whether it's out of fear, I leave that up to the panel.
When the estranged husband found the first baby, we should point out he called her first, then he called police. That's number one. The second thing is police are also questioning her boyfriend. She has a current boyfriend right now.
Thank you.
They're also questioning
there you go.
Him to see if he knew anything.
On.
She's been living with this boyfriend for
there
a couple
go,
of
Wendy.
Years now, and apparently they had an on and off.
Oh,
just facts to digest.
We bring us to this man here. Who is he? Who is this guy with the cigarette? Well, this is her current boyfriend, Jimmy Brady, who lived with Huntsman for more than 18 months, began a relationship in 2011, led to Huntsman's eviction. Huntsman miscarried their child earlier this year. Take a listen, though, before we talk about Jimmy Brady, take a listen to what his brother had to say.
Nothing at all. She was, like, just really nice. Never would have guessed.
Let's talk about, though, Joseph Scott Morgan, about identifying these babies. Will it be possible to identify forensically through DNA if, in fact, all these babies have the same mother, the same father?
Well, let's keep in mind, Vin, that these are newborns. So the only shot that we're going to have at this, or that the authorities are going to have at this, of getting these little angels identified is going to be vis-a-vis DNA. Now, the further out that we move in time, the more desiccated these remains will be, the ones that occurred early on, we might have a very difficult time trying to extract a viable DNA in order to go back in and do a parental match and trying to place the DNA along the maternal line and the paternal line relative to the father. I think that this is another big question that we have to ask. Did this man that she was involved with, did he father all of these children? I think that's a big question as well.
That's a huge question. And is that, in fact, related to the motive here? Is she with someone and perhaps, you know, having an affair? And that's the reason behind all these murders?
It was later found that the DNA did show Darren to, in fact, be the father of all of these children. So just a little recap. From 1996 to 2006, Megan had 8 pregnancies, one of which was Sawyer, their youngest daughter. The other 7 were just hidden in the garage. During this time, Darren was not in prison. It was before the police arrested him for those drug-related charges. Medical examiners also noted that the amount of time that had passed between the pregnancies, the level of decay made it almost impossible to know with certainty the order of when these babies were born. They also couldn't really tell exactly when they passed away because it had been almost 10 years ago. They did, however, note that 5 of the babies were female and 2 of the babies were male. While the police were searching the home, one of the babies in the box had a chemical odor that was described to smell like iodine. Police also mentioned that all 7 of these babies, well, 6 out of the 7, were strangled within 2 minutes of life. The 7th baby was actually born, stillborn. While talking to the police, Megan was quoted, "Depression and alcohol took a hold of me, the same way drugs did. I cannot give a reasonable answer to why I did such a sick and heinous crime. I held my secret for 18 years. In some small way, I wanted to help these babies avoid the terrible life I would have given them, and I would have deprived my little babies the opportunity of life." Again, Utah had that safe haven law. She had every opportunity. If she didn't feel like she could take care of these babies, that she would be a terrible mother, she could have given them to somebody who would appreciate the life rather than take it away.
Yeah, so quickly, just to take it away, to be instantly born and then instantly die. Yeah, this safe haven law honestly was the answer to everything that she was asking. She didn't want to raise a baby. She didn't want to give it a horrible life. And she had that resource and she didn't use it.
Police say Megan Huntsman's methamphetamine addiction is what led directly to the murder of these babies and a stillbirth of the 7th. She told officers, she said specifically, she had to choose between the drugs and the babies, and she chose drugs. So the question tonight is, does addiction explain it all, or is something more sinister here? Yasmin.
You know, Dr. Drew, you know this best. You know addiction best. But I mean, this is just an awful story. I feel like to a certain extent, addiction has to explain it all. I mean, when you're that ensconced in being a meth head or a meth addict, you can't think of anything else. I personally am not an addict. I've never been an addict, thankfully. But I've seen people deal with addiction. I've seen people deal with alcoholism, not necessarily meth. But it's all consuming. You can't think of anything else. Well, I can't imagine that there's something else here that's going on.
And Vanessa, in spite of you hitting the nail on the head, you're not comfortable with this. I'll get your reaction. Let me just say, Yasmin's on to something, which is that when you have addiction, it's the sole priority in your life and everything else diminishes.
I get that. And I've seen addiction firsthand in my family. But at the end of the day, I have never heard of a story of someone killing 6 babies because of their addiction. There has to be something else.
Well,
and we need to look this father, too.
That's interesting.
Pleasant Grove police detective, his name was Dan Beckstrom. He testified at Megan's sentencing. And this was a very unusual move. But prosecutors called Detective Beckstrom because they wanted to have him tell the full story, because the full story never actually came out to the media. After the hearing, Detective Beckstrom stated, and I quote, "We did want to make sure that the judge understood everything that we dealt with as a department. To be able to give him a synopsis of everything we did to make him understand what Megan chose to do. We wanted the judge to understand all of this before he made his decision." In the courtroom, he does tell all of the details of the day. He mentioned that as police searched the garage, Megan Huntsman was being interviewed by the police. Initially, she insisted that the baby that was born and placed into the bag was actually the stillborn birth that she delivered. The stillborn birth was the very last delivery that she had, and it was birthed shortly after her husband went to prison. So she hid that body because she thought that she didn't know what else to do. Her husband left them. Which, in reality, if you were to just think of that one birth, I can understand the reason behind that. It's not, you know, like, given she's done this six other times, but if it was just that one simple case of, I don't know what to do, my husband went to prison, and I gave birth to a stillborn, that would be not only embarrassing to you as a mom, knowing that your, you know, your husband, the father of your baby, is in prison, but I mean, imagine all of the emotions that she was already going through on top of the hormones that she had because she was pregnant. The detective stated that about an hour into the interview with Megan, that's when police at the scene reported the second baby being found. In court, Detective Beckstrom described how each of the body was found and how each of the boxes were wrapped in layers of plastic or blankets, sometimes taped shut with electrical tape, and all of the investigators that were on the scene eventually determined that the bodies of five baby girls and two baby boys had been hidden in this home around 10 whole years. He mentioned it was horrible for his whole department, and some of the things that these officers saw in the garage, they'll never unsee. Now, Megan's attorney stated that while she wasn't initially forthcoming, she did eventually give a full confession, which should give Megan some leniency in sentencing. Detectives and the attorneys on both sides did note that without her cooperation, prosecutors wouldn't have had a case against her. During our interview with police, Megan did explain her story to them. Detectives asked her why she let her three oldest children live. She mentioned that, of course, her first two children were born before she and her husband started using meth. She was on drugs, and when she became pregnant with her third living daughter, she stated, "Sawyer was not murdered because the pregnancy was known. Had she concealed, she doesn't know whether or not there would be an eighth baby in a box." After Sawyer was born and Megan kept getting pregnant, because Sawyer was known to the world and other people, Megan was very careful to never disclose her other pregnancies. During the trial, two out of the three daughters did submit letters on their mother's behalf, just describing her as a loving parent who had done a good job caring for them rather than a cold killer, as some see her. In their letters, they also addressed their mother, and one of their letters quoted, "Nobody could guess my mom would do anything like this. No matter what anyone thinks you are a good person." It is still unknown how, you know, Megan and Darren treated their children during their drug abuse. Some people can still be highly functioning while on meth. Others can't. I can't really testify to how they raise their children, but just based off of the statements in the letters, it does seem like they were a loving family, regardless of the substance abuse going on. Megan's youngest sister, whose name was Jamie Huntsman, she wept while she read these letters from their daughters. She also gave her own statement where she mentioned that Megan is not a monster, she's not evil, and from what I understand, she was just scared. Other family members also noted that they didn't know about the meth use and also stated that the couple's lives were just joyous. They didn't know of any harm being done, any substance abuse in the home, any of the pregnancies. They thought they lived a completely normal and stable life. Joyce at this time, which was Megan's mother, she urged other parents to watch for the signs of addiction in their children. There was a study done in 1969 by a Philip Resnick. Now, he was a psychiatric professor at Case Western Reserve University, and he stated that this kind of killing is considered multiple neonatocide. This means that the killing of a child is within its first 24 hours of life. Now, this is just one of the filicide, which is the term often used for parents who kill their children, but mothers who commit neonatocide usually give birth to the child alone and kill. He also says that multiple neonatocides are very, very rare, especially among married women. Megan Huntsman is one out of a handful of women who have experienced this type of crime.
And yeah, and the question too is, why wasn't she on birth control? You know, why did she resort to killing right. them? You know, she could have had abortions. There's so many yeah. other options.
There's some deep psychological issue there, because it's not, oops, I made a mistake and I'm trying to fix a mistake, because first of all, you can get an abortion. Second of all, you don't do it seven times. You don't make that mistake seven times. There is a condition or a what do you call it? It's neonaticide is what it's called. There's infanticide that we've heard about, which is the killing of your child. That can happen in the first year or two. Neonaticide specifically is the killing of newborn infants less than a month old. This is actually something that happens on a regular basis. We just don't hear about it a lot because it's usually not seven of them. And the reason we don't hear about it is because it happens in the privacy of somebody's home and it's often undetected. So it's a condition that happens. We don't usually hear about it. It's a psychological disorder. She's not just like some crazy sociopath. This happens on a regular basis. And it normally happens with only the mother. The fathers don't typically commit neonaticide. Women who commit neonaticide typically, they denied or concealed the pregnancy since conception. They frequently give birth alone and dispose of the baby. I can't understand the reason for it. It's mind-boggling that nobody could have noticed this before. It's very, very disturbing. Research indicates low maternal self-esteem and emotional immaturity rather than the obvious mental illness or social disadvantage as motivating wow. factors.
That's shocking to me because in my mind, this is so incredibly reprehensible that in my mind, I resort to like mental illness. Like, you know, I want to say that the person was chemically imbalanced some way, but that it was due to immaturity or low self-esteem. Gosh, it makes me feel like people are capable of some really atrocious things, even in sort of their right mind, right?
Yeah, and here's a household. It looks like a normal household. It's one of those situations where neighbors say, well, she always seemed like a normal woman and everything seemed perfectly
Shocking.
Normal. So you never know what's going on behind the walls of these houses. But there had to be some deep dysfunction in the family when there's three children in the home, a set of parents, and nobody noticed.
Despite Megan's family's testimony, prosecutors insisted that there was no way to deny that she had carefully plotted to kill each of the six children without any of her family noticing, because she did have to clean up all of the evidence before they could see. And I did mention six because the seventh was stillborn, so they didn't really count that as neonaticide. But hiding and concealing the body afterwards was an additional charge. Another police detective stated, "These were very cold and calculated killings. She smothered or strangled six of her own flesh and blood." Now, the judge who was on the case also explained that he was the judge who signed the search warrant on the day that the babies were found. During that time, he had quietly hoped that he would not be assigned this case because he knew how troubling this was going to be. He was quoted, "I really thought I had seen it all until this case. It shocked me then and it still shocks me now." On April 20th of 2015, Megan is now 40 years old. She pled guilty to six counts of murder, a first-degree felony, and she was sentenced to six terms of 5 years to life in prison for murdering each baby between 1996 and 2006. She was then given additional years for packaging their bodies and hiding them in her garage. Fourth District Judge, his name was Darrell McDade, ordered three of those terms to be served consecutively, and the other three to be served concurrently. She will serve a total of 39 years in prison before being eligible for parole, but the judge McDade stated she doesn't think she's ever getting out. Now, this was a pretty packed case. There was a lot going on, a lot of, you know, depression disorders, and just a lot of information that could cause bodily harm to not only mothers, but their children, and maybe even other people involved in the family. I do want to finish Rachel Waters' TED Talk because she does describe these resources and breaking the stigma. So I'm going to leave it off with here. At the very end, just know that there are different resources for newly, you know, expecting mothers. There's postpartum support, which can be found at www.postpartum.net. And we will put all of this in our show notes as well. There's also a recovery village for prenatal substance abuse, and that can be found at www.therecoveryvillage.com, all one word. Lastly, there is another national helpline, which is free and confidential. It's 24/7, 365 days a year. There's treatment referrals and information services, both in English and in Spanish. These are for individuals and family that are facing mental or substance abuse disorders. It's called the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. That can be found at www.samhsa.gov. Again, all of this will be in our show notes. And yeah, I'm going to leave you with Rachel Waters on the rest of her TED Talk.
After my manic break, I tried so hard to think myself back to the realm of normalcy, and I blamed myself a lot. I constantly asked, how long am I going to feel this way? And when am I going to feel better? My husband didn't have the timeline that I was so desperately grasping for, but he assured me that I would recover. A woman may also have strange beliefs. I thought that everything that I read on billboards and books and magazines were direct messages telling me what to do. And I also felt like I had this divine power to affect the universe. The symptoms may present in a waxing and waning fashion, which means that the woman can appear normal and lucid in between the psychotic symptoms. Postpartum psychosis is treatable. A treatment plan usually includes medications, sleep aids, short-term psychiatric hospitalization, and counseling. The tragedy of postpartum psychosis is when women don't share the true thoughts and images going through their minds, because they fear the negative repercussions that may come from doing so. What if they take my kids away? What if they lock me up? After I recovered from my first episode of postpartum psychosis, I became aware of an incredible resource called Postpartum Support International, or PSI. They are the leaders in education, treatment, resources, and current research on perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. PSI's universal message is, you are not alone. You are not to blame. And with treatment, you will get better. This message is vital to women experiencing perinatal mood and anxiety disorders because there's so much shame, blame, and stigma surrounding maternal mental health conditions. Speaking these words is life-giving to women that may be struggling with their condition completely alone out of fear of judgment or the negative consequences of sharing those true thoughts running through their head. So what are the consequences of untreated postpartum psychosis? Suicide is the leading cause of maternal death up to 1 year postpartum. In women with postpartum psychosis, 5% commit suicide. Infanticide is also a very severe consequence of not treating the disorder. A third of women hospitalized for postpartum psychosis expressed delusions about their infants. And sadly, 4% kill their child. In the height of a manic episode associated with postpartum psychosis, women may also commit other acts that cause them to spend years in mental hospitals or even in prison. We must break down the stigma surrounding postpartum psychosis and other maternal mental health conditions. Women who may never have told anyone about their true thoughts and feelings after birth, the birth of their child, need to know that they are not alone. Everyone in this audience who is a mother, who knows a mother, and who one day may be a mother, need to be aware of the reality of perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. Break the epidemic of silence and allow women to feel safe sharing their true thoughts and feelings in the postpartum period. Without passing judgment, without labeling them as crazy, and instead guide them to the resources available to provide hope and healing. If you are a health professional that works with women who are pregnant or in the postpartum period, seek out continuing education on perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, how to treat them, and how to recognize them. If you know a woman who has just had a baby, seek her out. Ask her if she's sleepy or if she's having any kind of thoughts or images that she's been afraid to share with anyone. If we do this, and the woman that may be listening to this right now, feeling like there's no hope, that she will feel crazy forever, like I did, I want to speak to you and say, you can make it through this, and you can take care of your child again. You can take care of 4 children. And we all have days where we feel like we're losing it. But if we can support one another as a community, if we, as friends and family members and community members, recognize the vulnerability of women that bringing a child into this world can create, then we can foster healthy mothers. And we can support women in their greatest time of need. It is time that our society pay as much attention to the mother as the adorable baby that she was responsible for bringing into this world.